Welcome, everyone. I see a lot of familiar faces. Thank you for bringing me here. I know it's kind of a welcome day today, so kudos to you for making the extra effort. Before we get started with the panel, I'd like to get a sense of who's in the room. So I know we have museum educators, and we have people who are in kind of the social work of the medical professional field. So if you can raise your hand if you are a healthcare provider, social worker, medical professional, or administrator. Okay. Any family or professional caregivers in the room? Social workers? Educators? And how many of you have participated in a program other than your own if you're an educator? Okay. As many of you know, I manage Connect to Culture here at Caring Kind, and I'm very excited to have partnered with the Museum Access Consortium to host this workshop. This is a forum for us to reflect on the experiences that we offer to this population. In the next 2 hours, we'll hear from educators who have just piloted a program, to someone who was integral in putting these programs on the NYC cultural and accessibility map. We'll then have a chance to have a smaller breakout groups, each addressing a different obstacle to the program experience. The facilitator will lead a discussion about the obstacle, either one proposed by one of the presenters or one that a group identifies independently. The facilitators are Sarah, if you will raise your hand just so people know, Leslie, Katie, and either me or someone from the Museum Access Consortium. I'm going to give the facilitators a name tag when I get around to it. although I think we probably all know each other for the most part. We'll have a chance to share our findings afterwards when we come back from the discussion. Now I'd like to introduce today's panel moderator, Lindsay Goldman. Lindsay is the Director of Healthy Aging at the New York Academy of Medicine, under whose supervision the Media, Art, and Cultural Working Group discusses ways to make NYC age-friendly.
So I'm from the New York Academy of Medicine. How many of you have ever been there? Oh, more than usual. So we have been around since 1847. We work to advance solutions to improve the public health in cities worldwide. We do this through our Institute for Urban Health, where I sit. Through our Fellows Program, which is a network of over 2,000 professionals from across all different aspects of health and healthcare that are elected by their peers, and through our cultural and public programming in public health, medicine, and the arts, humanities. We have a really interesting collection. We're on 103rd and 5th. I would highly recommend you come visit the first Monday of every month. We have a tour at noon where you can see George Washington's original bottom dentures. That's for real. We have them. And the reason that I'm here is because one of our priorities is healthy aging. We also work on eliminating health disparities and preventing chronic conditions. And we serve as the secretariat for age-friendly New York City. Between the mayor's office, the New York City Council, and the New York Academy of Medicine that works to maximize the social, physical, and economic participation of older people. We do this to improve their overall health and well-being and also to strengthen the communities where they live. We use a top-down, bottom-up approach that engages and seeks to affect change within the public sector, the private sector, and at the neighborhood level. And it's all grounded in feedback that we solicit directly from older people themselves as experts on their own lives. Why do we do this? Well, we believe that the older population has a tremendous amount of social, financial, and intellectual capital to lend to our communities. Just to give you a sense of the population and some of their assets, about 15% are still working. $70 billion is accounted by older people in New York City in terms of consumer spending. 54% of all voters in New York City. 70% of all charitable donations. About 25% regularly volunteer. And this is a population that's growing. It currently comprises about 12%. projected to increase to 15% by 2040, at which point the number of older people will outnumber school-aged children. We use a framework developed by the World Health Organization that identifies 8 domains of an age-friendly city, things like transportation and housing, social participation, respect and social inclusion, civic engagement and employment. And basically, the theory is that if you intervene within those 8 domains, you can actually slow or reverse a person's disability trajectory. So our goal is to keep people above that orange line for as long as possible.
Can you take off those 8 domains again?
Oh, you know what? I took that slide out, but I can send them to you. But it's housing, transportation, let's see if I can do them from memory. Housing, transportation, outdoor and public spaces, respect and social inclusion, social participation. What am I missing? Yeah, I'm gonna send them to you. But it's all, you know, it's basically the built, the social, and the economic environment, right? All of those realms. So looking at the population, right now we have over 1 million people over 65, and this is projected to increase by over 40% to 1.4 million. This population is growing faster than the population at large, but they don't look like previous generations of older people. They're becoming more and more diverse racially, ethnically, and linguistically. So we have 46% of this population was born outside of the United States, and 33% speak English less than very well. That's a census category. The population that is currently 50 to 64 is actually even more diverse than the population 65 plus, but they are more likely to speak English than the current population of older people.
Oh, that's not supposed to say that. It's supposed to have an actual percentage.
Oh, good, so you have that, fabulous. All right, so what you can see here, in terms of where older people live, the majority live in Brooklyn and Queens. And why is this important? Well, when we talk to older people, they tell us that they much prefer to attend arts and cultural events near where they live. So while they do enjoy coming into the city, people who live in Co-op City, they want access to arts and culture in Co-op City. And so, you know, when you think about the programs that you offer on site, you might think about outsourcing those programs to other places where there are large concentrations of older people. In terms of their income and expenses, 63% of older New Yorkers have no retirement income, and the poverty rate for older people in New York City is actually twice that of the national population of older people. There are high rates of food insecurity, and people who are older, as with the general population, are paying most of their income on housing, right? We have very high rates of housing cost burden, whether you rent or you own. About 80% of older people have a rental subsidy, but among those people, a huge portion of them, somewhere around 50 to 70%, are still paying like 50% of their income on rent. It's just astronomical. The median income of older people is about $31,615, but these are people who have money. So even those who only rely on Social Security, they have some money, they're out in communities, they tend to want to spend it locally, they often prefer to spend money in cash rather than using credit cards. So, you know, they're loyal customers to those businesses that they patronize regularly, and they're more likely to rely on word of mouth rather than paid advertising. So this is a population who appreciates and benefits from discounts. About 60% of the older population has absolutely no disability, and most older people manage their chronic conditions like everybody else independently without any kind of support. That said, disability prevalence certainly increases with age, as well as the number of chronic conditions. And so we do have 28% of the population reporting ambulatory difficulty, 11% reporting hearing difficulty, and 8% reporting vision difficulty. 11% report cognitive difficulty. And whenever you see these kinds of statistics, you need to recognize that it's probably an underrepresentation because these are people who report having a certain disability as opposed to the actual number, right? If I asked my mother if she was hearing impaired, she would absolutely say no. And then she would say what? So, you know, self-reports are unreliable. So that's the demographic context. So what is the social and cultural context? Well, there's some recent research out of Penn that was funded by the New York Community Trust and some other funders that looked at the relationship between social well-being of neighborhoods and the presence of arts and cultural opportunities. And what they found was that there was a direct connection between the social well-being of low and moderate income residents in New York City neighborhoods with those neighborhoods that had many cultural resources. Those people were healthier, better educated, and safer overall than those people in similar communities with fewer arts and cultural opportunities. And I thought this quote was really telling, which says that culture is a critical resource that people use as part of that quest for a life of value. It can provide tools for making sense of the world. It can provide opportunities to develop one's abilities or to forge connections with people like themselves or not like themselves. Or it can simply provide enjoyment and satisfaction. This is why we've insisted that culture be seen as a central aspect of well-being that simultaneously has intrinsic value and contributes to other forms of social value. And so while this study didn't actually focus on older people as consumers or participants in arts and culture, it focused on neighborhoods. And what we know about older people is that neighborhood characteristics may actually affect them more than other age groups. Why? Because they may be less mobile, right? So they have a more limited catchment area for activity. And also because they tend to be long-term residents of their neighborhoods. So they've spent decades in communities exposed to they have higher levels of exposure to the neighborhood conditions, one of which may be the presence of a large number of arts and cultural institutions. And the other thing that we know is that older New Yorkers love arts and culture. When we talk to them and we ask them, you know, what do you love about the city and where are there barriers to you doing everything that you've always wanted to do? Why are you still here? The reason inevitably is, you know, the transportation is great, I can walk places, and all of the arts and culture and diversity. So that's why people stay here, why people come back here after living somewhere else, because it's interesting and there's so much to do. So for older people, we know, and this certainly applies maybe even more so to people with dementia, that arts and culture serves as both preventative and therapeutic. So what does the evidence say in terms of dementia and the arts? Because we know that there's evidence to support what all of us have probably seen or experienced anecdotally. So creative processes are associated with brain stimulation. We've seen that singing and visual arts is associated with improved cognitive capabilities. Singing and music leads to improved mini mental status exam scores. We've seen decreased depression symptoms and better attention and executive function. And we've seen that art viewing and making results in improvements in memory and increased engagement and communication. We've also seen that among people who don't have dementia, older people who participated in arts programming experienced less cognitive and physical decline, had fewer doctor visits and needed fewer prescription medications, and had fewer falls. So, I mean, this is really important when we think about all of those factors that influence health beyond just the healthcare sector. Arts and culture has tremendous potential to keep people healthy and prevent them from further declining. Some of the additional benefits that I don't have like a tremendous number of peer-reviewed studies to support, but I think are equally important. The value of arts and cultural experiences in providing normative, familiar, and safe spaces for people who have dementia and their caregivers. A lot of times it's just an achievement to be out of the house. It's not a big deal if there are difficult behaviors. I've experienced this firsthand. I am a social worker by training, and my first job in aging was as the director, I keep opening this cabinet, was as the director of a social adult day program for people with dementia. And very quickly into my time there, I went to the MoMA, Meet Me at MoMA program with my 17 clients and learned just how powerful that kind of experience could be. just the fact that, you know, people often don't want to go to an age-segregated kind of program, or if they do, they want to be in multi-generational spaces, spaces where they've always gone, where they feel normal, like museums and other kinds of cultural institutions. So being able to get out of the house and not having to worry about problematic behaviors is tremendously beneficial. Increased physical activity, if you're going somewhere, you have to get there somehow, so you're walking more. Social engagement, there are other people around reacting to whatever you're reacting to. The opportunity for life review and processing is really essential, and it's a role that arts and culture can play in the lives of people with dementia and their caregivers if the people who are running the programs aren't too scared to go there. But I think it's something that, you know, people really need to do. And, you know, finally, the benefit to the facilitator. You know, when I was running my program, I found that I had never been more personally fulfilled. I started to look at art differently and hear music differently, and your perspective kind of shifts when you're around people who, for whom really there is only the present. Did you want to ask a question?
Yeah, could you elaborate more on opportunity for life review and processing?
Oh, sure. So, you know, towards the end of life, I think that people who have dementia and those who don't start to reflect on what they've sort of contributed to the world and how their life has gone. And I think that, you know, there are ways of doing that through arts and culture that can be very therapeutic. So, you know, looking at a poem or a piece of art and having the opportunity to reflect on what that means to you personally, as opposed to presenting a group of people with dementia with, you know, something that's a little more sort of safe. I'll give a specific example, right? So I had this this poetry program, and the facilitator was wonderful, but was like a little bit uncomfortable with that sort of life review and processing, and like didn't really want to go there. And so she would select poems and songs that were, you know, indicative of her discomfort. Right, so there was one week where she wanted to focus on flowers, and she picked like, "I'll be meeting you in apple blossom time," or something like that. But meanwhile, I had a room full of people who were saying, "Why am I still here? Like, what is all of this? And how did this happen? And what?" People who were sort of in the, you know, moderate to later stages of dementia, who had the ability to articulate that and needed a space for it. And so instead of that song, we looked at the leaves that are green turned brown. And it wasn't uplifting, and it was sad, but it provided that space for them to sort of sit with each other and process what it meant to be older and to have lost some capacity and some independence. And so it wasn't safe, and it was pretty sad, but ultimately it was what people needed. They needed to be heard and to experience that and provide support to each other.
Well, I was going to say, if a narrative therapist had led the group, it would have gone so much better.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Well, I'm an art therapy graduate student, but there's also something called narrative therapy. If a narrative therapist had led such a group, it could have contained that and been more appropriate.
Thank you. Yes, I think narrative, what did you say, narrative therapist?
Yes, there's psychotherapists that specialize in creative writing.
Yes, we actually have a program right now at the Academy being led by someone from the Narrative Medicine Project at Columbia on growth and aging and using texts to, you know, consider the cultural and personal constructs of aging through time. So that's basically what I mean, you know, enabling people to use the arts as a way to process their difficult experiences or their happy experiences, whatever. But, you know, it can bring stuff up. And, you know, I think it's important for people to, if you're facilitating that kind of program, to be comfortable sort of going there and witnessing that kind of expression. And I know my time is almost up, so here are some considerations. When we hear from older people, this is not specifically people with dementia, but anything that older people without dementia tell us, right, and a lot of times those are caregivers for people with dementia, is applicable like times 10 to people who have dementia, right? Considering how people access information. information about programs that are available, whether the programming is relevant, whether it's interesting, is it in my language? Remember I said over 34% don't speak English, so it's important to think about linguistic competence and inclusion. When is the event? The timing is really key. People tell us they don't like to be out too late at night. How am I going to get there? I personally experienced this when I tried to take 15 people with dementia to the circus, bit of a challenge, without any sort of chartered bus. So how am I going to get there? And all of the logistics associated with getting there, and you know, if it's a bus, if it's a taxi, whatever. Can I afford it? Do I have enough disposable income? The physical environment, is there a place to sit down? Can I get to the bathroom? What's the bathroom like? The overall experience, will I feel comfortable with the other people there? And social factors, do I have someone to go with? That's often what we hear is a barrier to people participating in arts and cultural opportunities, that I want someone to go with and I just don't have anyone to go with. And a few final insights, I would say in doing programming for this population, you know, challenge your assumptions, don't dumb it down, don't only do the Apple Blossom Time song, but do the leaves that are green, turn to brown, look at the sad stuff. Consider cross-population initiatives. I've had a lot of success with programs that combine people with dementia with younger people with developmental disabilities. I think especially when there's the need for conversation partners and the need to practice socialization skills, the same sort of social interaction over and over again, people with dementia can actually be really good at that. For people who are younger and need to practice. Outreach through age-neutral channels. So I can give you a list of every single senior center in the city, and it would be great for you to do outreach there. But the reality is only about 10% of older people go to senior centers. I love senior centers. I used to work in one. They're fabulous places to be. No matter how cool you make them sound and rebrand them, there are people who are never going because of all the old people there. Outreach through libraries and local papers and all of those places and spaces that are multi-generational where people like to go. And finally, document and wherever possible, look for money to evaluate the work that you're doing because it's really important work and it's critical that we build the evidence base around the value of arts and culture for people with dementia and for people just generally as they age. Thank you.
Woo! Awesome.